can be reached at 825-0759 or at SchofieldSolarAndHeating.com. Coming up next is Thursday Night Talk. Stay tuned.
Good evening and welcome to Thursday Night Talk. I am your host, Lorna Bryant. This evening's edition of Thursday Night Talk is The Race Beat, where we discuss issues related to race. This evening, we are going to discuss the horrific thriller, satirical thriller, Get Out. Joining me in the studio are Jill Larrabee. She is the organizer for Show Up Humboldt. Malcolm Chinaiwa, he is a senior in HSU's Critical Race and Gender and Sexuality Studies program. And Dr. Patty Yancey, HSU Professor Emeritus, retired from the HSU School of Education, currently working as the principal investigator for the North Coast Arts Integration Project, and also independently as a visual artist. Welcome to you all, and thank you for joining me as we talk about this this interesting movie.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I'll be honest, it's been kind of a busy day, so we're just going to talk about this off the fly. I have some ideas that I want to run by you and the listener, and you are welcome to call in and join in the conversation. So, Malcolm, I'm going to start with you. When I first invited you on the show, you told me you were currently doing a research project on this movie. Tell me about your research.
So my research on Get Out is looking at where that film fits in sort of the canon of films about slave narratives. So it's kind of not a really obvious connection, because in fact, Get Out doesn't look on the surface to be a lot about slavery, but I think there's a lot of themes and plot devices and so on that really relate to the way that we craft narratives about slavery.
Okay. Patty, you saw the movie, I understand, two times?
Yes, I did. I got a lot out of it, I think more out of it the second time.
Okay.
And I'm really excited to hear Malcolm say that, because I definitely... that's where I went the second time with the comparisons and thoughts about slavery, the sunken place.
Yes.
Yes. And Jill, we saw the movie together.
Twice.
Yes. The second time?
The first time we cackled so much, we were over, you know, we missed a lot. But the second time we did see the slavery. I mean, we just saw so much more in depth, and we took notes, and it was so much more impactful.
Yes,
absolutely.
I agree.
So I'm going to start with something about my experience, but I'm going to go back a few years prior to the movie Get Out. I saw Django Unchained at Broadway Cinema in Eureka, California. I was one of two African Americans in the theater. The other African American woman was a friend of mine, and we sat side by side. And throughout the movie, there were the only part that I found uncomfortable was when they were calling Don Johnson's character Big Daddy. Mm-hmm. But was most uncomfortable was the laughter from the rest of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
The all-white audience laughing in places that I didn't find funny at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very uncomfortable for me. Then fast forward to Get Out. Jill Larrabee, my new sister friend, My new ally,
mm-hmm.
this white woman encouraged me to laugh out in parts where I said, oh, this is inappropriate. And she said, no, laugh. So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
why did you want to encourage me to laugh in places that I found were amusing and no one else in the audience did?
Because it's your space, it's your time, and people need to feel white people need to feel uncomfortable and know that this is a serious. It was done playfully and with integrity, but it was also
I get that, yeah. What you said about the, it was such a well-crafted movie and contemporary and horror, all that mm-hmm. wonderful stuff, mm-hmm. But yet what was feeding it and the was some really serious stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and we don't see that often in horror movies. Right. I'm a real Star Trek fan, and I remember years ago I would see these themes about the other, you know, how you treat others, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And no one else saw that. That was many years ago. So it brought me back to that.
So the music was pivotal in
yes.
the movie.
Yes, great yeah. music.
Starting with the movie from 20s vaudevillian era, Run Rabbit, Run Rabbit. And it was jarring. Malcolm, how did you feel about that, watching that young brother walking through the suburbs, as he said, and while that music was playing?
So the scene of him walking through the suburbs is already, you know,
terrifying,
absolutely terrifying, and a space that I think me and people like me have found ourselves far too many times. So there was already a real sense of dread, but the music on top of it was kind of, in some ways, it was distracting. Like I was like, I don't know what to pay attention to. Is this really creepy thing or the music that's also creepy in its own way? So there was this like almost double creepiness component going on that I've never really experienced in a film. It was, it was simultaneously like, jarring and distracting, but also it kind of coalesced in this way that was incredibly unsettling.
Absolutely. There's another song that was interesting because it mixed bluegrass and Swahili. Mm-hmm. And I have that song set in to play. So if my engineer can play that, a little bit of the song right now. Before I talk about this, I will say to the listener, there will be spoilers. Mm. I've always waited for that opportunity to say but there will be spoilers. So if you haven't seen the movie, just be aware. We will talk about the plot of the movie and specific scenes. But that song in particular was haunting. Mm-hmm. To begin with the sound of bluegrass, and then the sound, brother, brother, and then the Swahili. Does anyone know what was being said?
No.
No.
The underlying meaning makes it even more haunting. So the Sikalisa kwa wehenga is a Swahili phrase that translates, listen to your ancestors. Mm-hmm. And the song's lyrics loosely means something bad is coming. Yeah. Run. So now let's hear that song one more time, knowing what that means.
Thank you.
So, Malcolm, what is your reaction when you know what those lyrics mean now?
Yeah, so the song was already disturbing, just like how it sounded, but like lyrically, that's, and the way that it ties into the rest of the theme and the plot of the film, all of that is deeply troubling and disturbing.
Yes.
I almost wish that you hadn't told us that.
So the first time I heard it, it was eerie.
Yes.
It was truly eerie. And then to know, brother, the ancestors, listen to them. Something bad is coming. Run. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't understand that, get out.
Yeah.
Get out. So, Jill?
Was that during the beginning when they're preparing to go on the trip, right? So it started with the run rabbit in that suburb, like, in, automatically you're going, get out.
No, it was the very first song.
Before the run rabbit?
Yes, it was the credits.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
It was the credits. And then the scene began, and run rabbit was in that intro credit.
And then what was the song?
It was Childish Gambino.
Yes.
Redbone. Mm-hmm. And the hook in that song is stay woke. So the message in those songs were powerful. One in particular didn't even realize it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's such a wonderful compliment to Jordan, because like Malcolm said, I was feeling uncomfortable without knowing what the words were or what, you know, it was, I felt like you really set the scene with the music, and so that was very, you know, wonderful point.
Jordan Peele, talented, gifted, mm-hmm, actor, comedian, first-time movie director.
And writer. He wrote this.
Yes.
Right.
First time, and highest-grossing first-time director. Well, I won't even read. He broke all kinds of records. Mm-hmm. Highest-grossing movie from a first-time director. I think it was the highest-grossing horror film, I think, and how he skillfully put everything together in a comedic, horrific, satirical way. I was afraid to go to sleep. I'm not a horror person.
But in triumphant, like, that's the best part.
Yes.
You know, finally, the black guy doesn't die.
Yeah.
And finally. And at... You were actually thinking, okay, this is it.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, you know. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I think his comic timing, I thought was superb when scenes stopped, you know, when he shifted to something else. I thought that was brilliant, because if things had been held a little bit longer, mm-hmm, or cut off a little, it wouldn't have had it wouldn't have resonated as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. If you're just tuning in, this is Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat. I'm Lorna Bryant, joined by Jill Larrabee, Malcolm Chinawa, and Dr. Patty Yancey, also known as Patty.
Thank you.
And we're talking about the movie Get Out. If you'd like to join in the conversation, please give us a call at 826-4805. Outside of the local area, 1-800-640-5911. And if you'd like to text your question, because you're shy and you don't want your voice on the air, you can text us at 492-KHSU. So, Malcolm, there were a lot of subtle bits of racism that black men experience on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had that guess who's coming to dinner moment, and or just walking down the street and not involved in anything and been stopped by the police? Tell me about that.
So both of those kinds of types of experiences are ones that I've experienced personally, and they're both unsettling and disruptive to sort of my daily thing. And one of the things that I think that the film did really well is kind of leaving a little bit of ambiguity, right? So there's a number of scenes where the characters are experiencing racism or participating in some kind of racism, but it's left ambiguous enough that, you know, you kind of have to like side-eye the scene and say, what is really going on there? And of course, for people like me who have experienced this kind of thing frequently, it's immediately like a trigger, like, oh my gosh, like this weird thing. And it also kind of snaps you back to your own reality. And you're like, wait a minute, like, I thought this kind of thing only happened to me. So that might be the most disturbing part of the film, is that it shows you that there's a whole bunch of people who are experiencing a lot of these things, that these things resonate with them just like it resonates with me. So,
yeah. So have you ever had to have that conversation? Did you tell them before we get there that I'm black?
Yeah. That's been an experience of mine that there were a lot of things in Get Out that seemed almost stolen from my diary. I'll say that. I'm trying to be tactful.
Okay. Have you ever had a father tell you, the love is real? I voted for Obama twice, and if I could have voted a third time, I would have?
I didn't hear that one. Although, I'm sure, I don't know, maybe it might happen still.
let's talk about the research that you're doing right now.
I'm just looking at, my interests have already been slave narratives, especially slave narratives in film, because for the last handful of years, we've been seeing all kinds of films coming out about slavery, telling stories through slavery, everything from, you know, you mentioned Django, we've seen 12 Years a Slave really jump off, Belle is one that I really liked. So we're in a moment right now where we like to tell a lot of stories about slavery, but I'm really interested in the way that those kinds of ideas and themes and stories have kind of crossed over into a different genre. So to take what's already a really complicated and really rich genre and form of storytelling and to apply it in a way that makes it different but really similar, I thought that was really interesting and commendable about Get Out. So,
yeah. Let's talk about the role of the black woman in the movie. Now, I'm sure there's a connection in your research because throughout, historically especially, slavery period, the black woman has played a pivotal role in freedom, mm-hmm. in protection, mm-hmm. in birth. And there were only three black women in the movie. Two seen, one not. I've read a lot about these three women. The character Chris's mother was left on the side of the road for dead, and no one helped her. The second woman was the detective. And usually the black woman is the one who saves people and protects, protects the black man. She laughed at the story of Chris being missing and made light of it. And then there was Georgina. Georgina was a queer black woman who didn't react to the outside forces of a flash or a handshake that the other characters that had the surgery. She reacted with her emotion. And when the character Chris said something to her, she smiled. But through that smile, tears fell. And it was painful to see this woman fighting with her emotions between the reality and the reality she once knew and the reality she was now in. I'm going to look to you, Patty, for that. Mm-hmm. Just as an African-American woman, what did you think about some of those images of the black woman in this movie?
Well, of course, Georgina was pivotal and stood out for me more than the others. And I think her lack of affect was actually more powerful for me. I mean, she's just her her manner, just the camera goes to her and her just standing there. It was, you know, I always look at the acting. I mean, her, the way her eyes were almost crossed, as if she was looking at a point somewhere that, you know, you couldn't see. I thought she, you know, the actress, actor did an amazing job. And then the character, was, because she was the, you know, in the kitchen or serving or whatever, but I thought she was so powerful, and such a powerful piece. And then I don't know if I should spoil the big part of it. I won't. But it made me, in thinking about the sunken place, what I thought of was, if you stay in the sunken place, like Georgina, for a long period of time, and that's what made me think of the connection with the slavery, you know, what if you have kids? Kids are born in the sunken place. And that's how that was my connection with the slavery piece of, you know, you have children. Children are born, they cannot get out of, you know, we're talking about, you know, from 1600 on, there was, you know, abolition that wasn't even something people thought was even possible. So that really made me think of people living, dying, having children in this place.
Do you think that might have been the cause for her reaction? It may have been a maternal feeling that she had when she looked at Chris. And through her smiles, there were tears, and all she could say was, no, no. That was jarring to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I like what you said, Patty, about sort of her, Georgina's lack of affect, because that's a lot of how I'm tying the female characters in Get Out to slave narratives. Is what we see often is that slave narratives have to do mostly with men finding some way to physically overcome slavery, either by like running away or outsmarting their masters, or by like literally fighting them off. So what it does is it creates gaps in the storytelling for Black women, who often have all kinds of other implications under the system of slavery that prevent them from simply running away or fighting off their masters. And so you were mentioning like motherhood and childbirth and stuff in the sunken place, and that's actually a lot of where the stories of slavery kind of get lost, is because if you have a kid, you can't necessarily just pack up and run away from slavery. You know, you kind of have to maneuver and navigate. And there are some narratives that do a really good job of articulating that and grappling with those issues. But even now, in our current moment, where we're telling stories about slavery that look into the past and are often fictionalized, we're still kind of struggling to incorporate those stories. And in Get Out, we see an example of a Black female character who maybe starts to point to some of the ways that our narratives are in need of some more depth.
And there, I feel there's a connection also to, in thinking about intergenerational trauma.
Absolutely.
Of how things are passed on through families, through, you know, what you've gone through. I think about things my grandparents and great-grandparents went through, and I don't know the specifics, but I feel those things, or they come out in odd ways. Sometimes I don't even know why I'm reacting to a particular person or a particular song or whatever. I think you know, that whole thing of it's in your blood, you know. So it goes from generation to generation, and you carry things. And that's one thing I was thinking about, the sunken place, you know, looking at the affect of some folks that I think when I was a kid, and there was a sort of a, people that reminded me, of course, of Georgina, and friends that I had, of where it's like, It's like they couldn't get out, you know? And that's, I think that title is just, it's, there's so much in there, not only just the horror thing of like, get out.
So do you think Georgina's character might have been loosely similar to that of an Uncle Tom in the slave quarters? Because she was protecting the Artemidge family throughout the entire movie. But she was torn at the same time. Jill?
But what percentage, that was, I've been thinking about that. What percentage of it is it was the grandmother, the white grandmother? Like, what percentage of the father, the grandfather, that was Georgina's? Like, what percentage of both of those people, their brains were coming out, was their real brains, Georgina's real brain versus the grandmother's, and how much was it really being subservient to the white family, or were grandmother being the grandmother? I don't know.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
I can't answer that. And maybe that was the source of her tears, where she was torn, where she wanted to come out and save as the black mother, Chris, but also as the white grandmother, protect her family. I can't answer that.
And you brought up a good point, Lorna. I mean, about the whole, you know, thinking of individuals that we may call Uncle Toms. And I think we, in our contemporary time, can belittle those folks, have them sort of be a one-note kind of individual. But they're complex. I mean, there's so much going on there that... we can't just say,
There were many jokes about Dr. Ben Carson being in the sunken place.
Interesting.
But my association, there have been many, many memes and jokes about Dr. Ben Carson being in the sunken place. But I looked at Dr. Ben Carson... through another lens. I looked at Dr. Ben Carson through the lens of his profession. He's a neurosurgeon.
Mm-hmm.
What was the father of the Rose's character?
Mm-hmm.
He was the neurosurgeon. So I think of Dr. Ben Carson in 45's cabinet as the director of housing and urban development as a neurosurgeon, and all I could think of all of those young brothers that he may encounter. I hope his role is not in the cabinet to actually brainwash brothers and bring them over to the other side. So when I think of Dr. Ben Carson, it scares me, it terrifies me. But nah, really, he's just in the sunken place. Malcolm, that affected you when I said that.
Just like all the Ben Carson sunken place memes are just like rolling through my head now.
Yeah.
That was definitely part of the rhetoric, I think. So one of the ways that I think that Get Out was really resonant with us is that in our current political moment, I think there were moments in the film that really spoke to some real life things, and not just on like a personal, like this happened to me kind of level, but on a large scale political, like this is happening to us as a nation, us as a people kind of thing.
Sadly.
Sadly.
Yes, but true. If you're just tuning in, this is the KHSU. This is KHSU. I forget where I am. And the show is Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat. I'm Lorna Bryant. Joining me are Jill Larrabee, Dr. Patty Yancey, and Malcolm Chiniowa. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 826-4805, toll free at 640-5911. And you can text us at 707-492-KHSU. The sunken place. Let's talk about the sunken place. Jill, what did that sunken place, how did you feel when you saw Chris's character go into that sunken place?
It was paralyzing. I was feeling like I was feeling sunken with him and wanting him to get out, as we say. And it was just to me, it was what we're saying, like nationally, what's happening, and just watching it happen in a microcosm like way.
And you can't get out.
Yeah. This the teacup, just watching her and how I was so
paralyzed.
Yeah, I was scared of her.
For me, wow, I think that the sunken place represents like so many, there's so many things that I can think of the sunken place. I think of it as like the symbolic of maybe the lack of consciousness that we have to to exist in a world like this or in a country like this. And the struggle to get out is the struggle to develop an affirmative race consciousness in the context of a very white supremacist world. So I really sympathized with Chris while he was, you know, being asked to sink or suggested that he sink. And knowing that maybe a lot of us are kind of grappling with this, like with the difficulty of having an affirmative racial consciousness.
You ever feel like you're in the sunken place when you're sitting in a classroom here on the campus of Humboldt State University?
Absolutely. Oh, yes. Yeah. I feel like all of my professors have like teacups in their hand. Not all of them. Okay, that's messed up.
However,
many of my professors and bosses that I've had, and you know, because I think in a lot of ways there's like, and maybe this is one of the benefits of the film, is that there's an ignorance maybe from white people about the way that my world is kind of different and the ways that they ask me to sort of see things from their perspectives and operate within their worlds in order to get by. And that happens a lot as a student at HSU, right? Like I have to be able to speak the way that these people speak and walk the way that they walk in order to get through this university, to get out of this university. So.
How does that make you feel as an educator, as a professor, Patty?
In this country, probably in the world, as an African American woman, I don't know if it would be the sunken place, but you definitely have to deal with it if you are going to get ahead. Getting a doctorate or being in the work world or business world, I think there are many times where I know I've felt, I don't know if it would be the sunken place, but I do have an out-of-body experience with things going on around me. And, you know, I have there's a narrative going on in my head. I'm watching what's going on out there. And then there's my narrator that's going like, what the? And, you know, and all that's going on at the same time. And then, you know, what comes out of my mouth, though, can't be what the, but it's, you know, so it's like easing into the water. And it's interesting. Yeah, I don't know how any person of color LGBT, any other cannot experience that. It's because you are on a different plane. You're in a different place, but yet you're here. It's kind of like a wormhole or something.
A rabbit hole? Yeah. We have a caller from Arcata. Hello?
Hi. How's it going?
I am good. How are you, caller? Does the caller have
good,
a name? Would you like to
call me Roy?
Okay, Roy, how are you?
Good.
What is your question or comment?
I just wanted to see what you guys had to say about the generally in our country and politics, racism is often portrayed as like kind of a white trash, hillbilly, like uneducated, ignorant thing. But in the case of this movie, they were a very well-to-do upper-class white family, and also one of the scariest characters for me as like a middle-class white guy was the younger brother, who was the creepy ponytail murderer. I was curious what you guys had to say about that. And I'll take my comment off air. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Well, I thought that was fantastic. That was one of the really interesting parts of the film. As someone who looks a lot at slave narratives, I think one of the reasons why we tell slave narratives or have been telling them lately is because it allows us some kind of critical distance, right? So we can say like, okay, but that was in the 1800s and in the South. So mm-hmm. if I'm living in 2017 on the West Coast, and I'm like, I can say, okay, those guys over there were clearly messed up and racist, mm-hmm. and walk away feeling a little bit better about myself because I'm not like owning slaves. But with Get Out, you know, just like the caller said, like, you know, we have to look at the fact that these characters are well-to-do, seemingly liberal white people who in other instances can distance themselves from racism but are now being shown as the not creators, but producers of racism in the everyday, and I thought that was great.
Remind me of, maybe a caller or one of you can remind me of the period in the 1920s, I can't remember the name of the group, in New York, where they were very, very, very wealthy white people who wanted to preserve a pure, educated, elite white race.
I don't remember the group, but it was the eugenics.
Yes.
And it wasn't Emma Goldman.
I can't remember the woman, but there was a woman leading the eugenic movement.
And actually, she helped found Planned Parenthood.
Yes.
And the people who are anti-Planned Parenthood now are using that as saying that Planned Parenthood right in these days and age are eugenicists, and they're trying to to control our society with abortion. So it's kind of all cyclical. But yes, that was what I got from the...
I have always had, and this might be controversial in saying this, but I have always had, I know Planned Parenthood does great things, and for many people, it is the only form of health care that is available to them. Mm-hmm. But I always think of their beginnings mm-hmm. and the eugenics, mm-hmm. and it has progressed and morphed into mm-hmm. something different. But I always think about that and Anne Rand and all of that. When watching this, I just kept thinking about the eugenics movement and the elite white educated people who wanted to preserve that.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to Roy's question. This is what we need to talk about. What he's saying, like, oh, everyone thinks white trash. No. What we're talking about the system when you're talking about white supremacy, and we need to talk, like, that is the norm. What that Armitage family was, it's an extreme, but it's the norm. It's what Humboldt County is a huge example of that. And so as white people, we need to see that so we can deconstruct that.
Absolutely.
And we need to laugh about it, too, so we know that it's not our fault, but we need to fix it.
Yeah, with liberal racism, that's when you get, I love your hair, can I touch it? And
it happens in a lot of different ways. I know I have some, you know, really good friends that have lived in Humboldt County all their lives, and older folks, and are really... shocked to when we have a conversation when I am honest about maybe different things that are going on, and they're shocked. It's like, well, you know, they come across as like, well, don't you feel lucky to be here? At least you don't have to deal with that here.
But why should we deal with that?
And it's so interesting. Yeah, and it's so interesting. It's like, you know, it's like, well, yes, it happens here too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it happens everywhere.
Right.
And but we are in a place where folks think it's more of a utopia, so racism isn't a part of our everyday life here.
Because they can choose to, they choose to ignore it, and they choose to not challenge themselves, and they choose to get angry if someone says something about it, or defensive.
Well, and that brings up a good point, because sometimes I don't think some of them are choosing not to see it, mm-hmm. and maybe we can right. tie that into the right. film. Mm-hmm. I don't think they see it. I think it's right in front of their face, but it's like we've got this scrim or something where it's like, oh, I see it. Well, it's the movie. I see it, but you don't see it. Wow, and we're at the same table.
Yeah, and when I see it and I react, oh, you're just sensitive about race. No, you're yes. oblivious about it.
Yes.
There's a difference. Yes. There's a difference. Even, let's not make everything about race, but everything is about race right. in some way or another, unfortunately.
I mean, this ties back to our experience at seeing Kamau Bell.
Oh, yeah, mm. yes, mm-hmm. yes.
I mean, and he was clearly telling white people, I love you, white people. I love you so much that I married a white woman, and I'm having babies with a white woman. But they were still getting defensive. You know, a lot of reactions in the audience, or maybe hidden reactions of the white people in the audience were, they were too fragile for it. It was very.
There will be another Thursday night talk. The race beat, a postscript to the W. Kamau Bell show, actually, because a lot of things happened in that performance, during that performance, during the question and answer session in that performance, yes. and the fallout after that, actually with a former guest of mine. So we will, we're going to double back on that. Looks like we have a caller from Arcata. George, thank you for your call. What is your question or comment?
Hi. I was thinking when you were talking about, I was thinking about a few things. My daughter actually got me to see this movie, she said, Dad, you ought to see this. But anyway, I was thinking that the sunken place, that he was really in emotional bondage where he couldn't even hardly move. And I also thought that Georgina, where that one scene was riveting, I agree, but also the other fellow that was abducted in the beginning where he was bleeding from his nose, you know, there was when something would happen where it would jar, you know, a deep emotional reaction, which was deeper than maybe that surface. Then they had a hard time dealing with it. And then the other thing I noticed is, you know, the stereotypical behavior, of course, from the family, but then also even when Chris met the fellow that had been abducted first, I forget his name.
Logan.
Where he thought he was a friendly face, and he went up to him like a brother, but then he soon found out that something was wrong, and I thought that was good that it was brought up from the stereotypical behavior all around. Anyway, those are my comments.
Thank you, George.
Thank you so much.
Logan didn't know the brother handshake. Logan was actually in. A senior citizen white man from upstate New York. He wasn't a brother from Brooklyn, like Andre Hainsworth, the jazz musician. So, yeah, he
did. Well, thank you so much, and I'll get off now.
All right, thank you. Thank you for your call. The use of the sunken place was an interesting thing because it took Rose's mother, the psychotherapist, used a painful moment that was in the back of his mind to take him there. Mm-hmm. The loss of his mother, where he felt, I don't know if he felt responsible for her death, but she was treated as a throwaway. And remember, he couldn't stop watching TV, and then television became his crutch or his protection because he knew something was wrong and he didn't want to stop watching TV to learn the inevitable. And after his mother's death, he no longer watched TV. And she used the pain of the loss of his mother and the TV, the television, mm-hmm. as tools to control him. Hmm. That was powerful.
And the deer, the beginning.
Yes. So do you think they brainwashed in the movie a deer to come out at that very moment? Because that began the path. That mm-hmm. set the tone for the whole movie. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting about the whole TV thing because... in a way, we are subjected to, I don't know, willingly, we're being brainwashed 24/7. I mean, and if you can watch a screen and working with young children, trying to get them to be critical observers of media is a really hard thing to do. Because there's just so much coming at you through that medium, and if you're not critical, or if it's you just think it, or you think it doesn't mean anything, so you just consume. It's that can take you to the sunken place.
So can Facebook go willingly? Yes. Social media.
And you go willingly.
Yes.
I mean, you choose to go there. But after a while, you're losing your free will. So,
yes. There was a. Go ahead, Jill.
I was just wondering what everyone here thought about the fetishizing, especially from Rose on black men and the stereotypes, and just it's so palpable and awful to me.
Well, let's
not human.
Expound on that a little bit. When I first met you, you talked about that mm-hmm. In your experience, how maybe some of your friends or people you've come across, mm-hmm. how black men and Latino men were exotic, mm-hmm. and it was like a conquest. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
It's
you can say disgusting.
Yeah, it's disgusting. It's just it's dehumanizing. I mean, as a woman, and as a woman with breasts, I know about it since, you know, you're 10 years old and you get dehumanized for your body parts. So just by being, and just by being a person of color, and that you're an object—it's objectifying. You're an object, and she, Rose herself, was like the stereotypical in all the ways that a white woman in the way does it. You know,
checking out the scouting reports of,
yes.
of African American men stereotypically because they're basketball players with the NCAA.
She's drinking her milk
and eating her Fruit Loops.
Yeah. And I didn't know if anyone felt that when they were watching it, if it made their backs of their neck tingle.
So my understanding of fetishization is this: so fetish in the sense of like an idol or like a figure that you would have, mm-hmm. Where maybe this thing represents something larger, but it's itself an object. Mm-hmm. So fetishization in the sense that Chris kind of became maybe the vessel for or the idol upon which all these white folks were kind of foisting their mm-hmm. understandings and fantasies, sexual or otherwise, about blackness and black bodies. Mm-hmm. So the scene where they're at the party together and, right. you know, they're running into all of these white couples and, you know, these white folks are saying making all these commentaries right. and surveys of Chris's body and is asking, you know, let me see your golf swing or, right. you know, the woman who's asking about, you know, the sex, is it really better? Mm-hmm. That was disturbing, but that's the kind of thing that, you know, gets reiterated. And I think there's always a sexualization component, like a hypersexualization, mm-hmm. like, you know, so the part with the woman asking about is the sex better is, of course, spot on. Mm-hmm. But I think the other part of it is, I know.
That was ever so subtle.
Sorry. But also, you know, just the way that Chris kind of becomes, like I said, the vessel for these white folks' fantasies, sexual or otherwise, is just real.
Right. But let's call that scene exactly what it was.
Yes.
They were sizing up the body that they wanted for the silent auctions. Mm-hmm. I will never, ever look at a silent auction the same way ever in my life. Mm-mm. But they were vying for what they wanted. The woman who asked, is the sex better? Maybe I can get him. Or the Asian man who asked, I guess he was testing his intellect. I can't remember the question, but it was a very thought-provoking intellectual question about his experience navigating through life as a black man. The other question was the golf swing and how strong and virile he was. And yeah, he was being sized up for what their specific need was. Dr. Armitage's main focus was white people have determination, but black people have, let's see where, natural gifts. We have natural gifts, but white people have determination. And I think,
Well, when you think about that, at the whole, you know, it's like, of course, the movie takes it one step further, but in thinking about taking whites, taking things from blacks, let's say, music, I mean, that's been, you know, my goodness, since the beginning of time, and then taking it, making it their own, and then discarding the, you know, where it came from.
Right.
So it's, I think there's that brilliant scene in Dreamgirls where, you know, I think it's the James Brown character is, you know, singing about my new car, and then I saw it on stage, and then the stage shifts, and then you see, you know, sort of the Frankie Valli, you know, the blonde singing in my new car, and it has and it's same words, same melody, but it's kind of like, well, now it's ours.
Pat Boone's album covers.
Yeah, so
it's the Isley Brothers.
So I think it's really deep. I mean, that's been going on for a very, you know, forever.
That brings me to a comment that someone texted in a comment. A banjo, which I connected to bluegrass,
African
instrument, and that is exactly what. That's exactly what the texter said.
Yeah, and there was we had a wonderful person that came to campus some years ago. I think it was for the Dialogue on Race. It was a long time ago. Angela Wellman, who's an Oakland musician, jazz musician, and went to get her doctorate in Wisconsin. And so when she came to do her presentation, it was on the banjo. And, you know, it was like, that was my first time really realizing the origins of the banjo. And, oh, it was just amazing. And everybody was riveted in the audience, like, the banjo?
Then you have the likes of Rhiannon from the Carolina Chocolate Drops, an African-American bluegrass band, who kind of did a mashup of a Blue Cantrell song on the banjo, but that's another story. We are almost out of time. Let's have a couple of closing thoughts about that sunken place and how we experience that sunken place, and maybe how we as a nation, as a world, a community can protect ourselves from being in that sunken place.
Conversation. I mean, what you're saying about the screens and the TV and how it was paralyzing, and the more conversation and the more that we can humanize one another, we can get out of that sunken place and we can live more in the present and less, more proactive.
Yes. Yeah. Malcolm?
I think I'm going to steal something that Patty, you were talking about earlier. Maybe a little bit of critical media literacy is in order. So being able to create dialogue through films and music about our current situation and being really thoughtful about the way that we consume that dialogue.
Yes. Well, mine is knowledge. You got to read. You got to, you know, suck it up from wherever. You know, don't just have one channel. And that's something that's happening now as when you, with the, you know, with what's his name?
That guy.
Not, you know, kind of devaluing reading.
Yes. Right.
Reading.
Because he is not a learned person.
And, but it's like, but you can see us almost going there on our own with our phones, with the TV, with media. And it's, there's a lot of information that is not on the screen.
Right.
So.
So I think our charge is not to go into the sunken place.
Voluntarily.
Yes, to educate ourselves and to stay woke.
Yeah.
And listen to the ancestors. Yes. Listen to the ancestors. Something bad is coming. Well, you know, after November 8th, we knew something bad was coming. Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring it back to the political part. And this whole time and space that we are currently in, Get Out, the motion picture, came out at a pivotal time after the inauguration. And what I see in this movie, starting dialogue, what I see with the current administration, starting dialogue, starting true, real activism. People who have never had any inclination to be involved in politics are voting now and thinking about politics and their role in it. So I guess this is our stay woke moment.
And not taking, being satisfied with the simple answer.
Right. Yes.
That is, you know, that's key.
Yes.
Just it's never simple. If it's simple, there's something wrong.
Absolutely, man, truly. I want to take a short, brief moment to acknowledge David Josiah Lawson, who was taken from us too soon. Just to acknowledge not only his life and what he meant to so many of us in this community, both, I never met him, but through his mother and his family today, our community got to know him. Love each other.
Mm-hmm.
Love each other. A young man said a couple of days ago, your eyes are the biggest liar to you. Close your eyes to hatred and racism and anger and open your heart to love each other. There is on KHSU's website a full interview with Josiah Lawson's mother, Charmaine Lawson, and other family members and members of Brothers United. So if you'd like to take a listen, please go and do so, so you will know Josiah, not as a storyline, but as a person. And that interview will introduce you to who he was and not what happened to him. I'd like to thank my guest, Jill Larrabee, Malcolm Chinawa.
Thanks for having me.
Patty Yancey.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to my engineers, Katie Whiteside and Jessica Eden. The Thursday Night Talk producer, Geraldine Goldberg. Thank you to the callers, and love each other. Have a good evening.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been listening to Thursday Night Talk right here on KHSU. Thank you to our hostess, Lorna Bryant, and to all of her guests. We enjoy receiving feedback on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Coming up on the next Thursday Night Talk, host Brenda Starr is joined by members of the North Coast Rape Crisis Team, HSU Women's Center, and the Check It Program to discuss sexual assault and sexual harassment, awareness and prevention in the age of Trump, and your calls, starting at 7 o'clock on April 27th. Thanks to KHSU.